Blog Talk Radio.
Coming soon, the movie geeks continue the Kubrick series with Episode 2, an in-depth exploration of the mysteries of 2001, A Space Odyssey, with nearly 24 special guests.
Definitely is a spiritual dimension to 2001. Mm-hmm. In fact, Hal, if you switch the letters around, you get ALH, which you know as in Allah, and it's also the three primary consonants in the Hebrew word Elohim, which is the standard word for God in the Old Testament. But it's Hal is not ALH. Hal is that twisted up, right? And again, you look at the one eye of Hal, and you connect it with the eye of the pyramid, which is supposed to represent God and the dollar bill. And again, these connections are there. The question is, you know, what does it really mean? And I don't know, but I know that Hal is definitely the demonic side of all of this. The red eye, right?
The Kubrick series, Episode 2, The Ultimate Trip, coming later this month on Movie Geeks United. For more information, go to moviegeeksunited.net/Kubrick. United is here, the last quasi-live episode prior to the new year.
Wow.
Because we're going to do the 2001, but that's all kind of packaged already.
Right, yeah.
On December 29th. So this is so long for the remainder of the year for roundtable talk.
All right, okay, I gotcha. Happy Merry Christmas and a happy New Year early for everyone.
Absolutely. Hey, man, I got your card. Thank you very much.
Hey, anytime.
Now, do you observe the holidays?
I observe all the holidays. I do. For what they're, I mean, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I
just,
do.
Just
in our own way. Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah.
I don't believe in any of that. Oh, you know, I say Merry Christmas all the time. So yeah.
Good. Well, yes. Merry Christmas to everyone. We do have a big treat. We're going to play some a holiday music at the end of the show.
Oh dear.
Probably only a big treat for me because you know who sings the holiday music. But you know, it's
Sweet. All right.
Yeah, it's not me. It's Barry. So.
Oh, Barry. Oh, okay. I thought you were first going to say Al Pacino was singing it, but you know.
Chestnuts roasting. Yeah, that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you doing tonight?
I'm okay, man. I'm doing all right. All right. You want to get the Reese Witherspoon movie out of the way?
Oh, you saw it. Okay.
Yeah.
First of all, is it snowing? Are you snowbound there?
No. It snowed a little bit on Thursday, but that's it. It didn't snow. No, we didn't get any snow.
Oh, good. It's a different story than it was last year, I guess, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's good. Tell me, hang on. We got Aaron on the line. You want to? Bring up Aaron and we can talk movies.
Yeah, sure. Is that where, does he want to talk about it too? Or
I don't think he's seen it. Hey, Aaron. Hey, hang on. Let me try that again. Hey, Aaron.
Hey.
How are you?
Happy Hanukkah.
Hey, happy Hanukkah. Merry Christmas to you, my friend.
Merry Christmas.
Happy
I was
month.
Liking the Pacino Sings. I'd buy that record. Pacino
Thank
Sings.
You. I should do that. I should make an infomercial, like one of those KTEL Records infomercial and just have Pacino singing various holiday songs.
Al sings the classics.
Okay. Jerry, what'd you think of How Do You Know?
Did they? Is that a? You know, I want to like paraphrase a.
When a review starts in a question, that's not a good sign.
It's not grounded at all.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's a huge problem for film. I understand like the characters' motivations and everything, but it just doesn't feel like there's any focus whatsoever. It seems like a series of vignettes almost put together. It's the most sitcom-like of his recent films.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like Seinfeld, you know. It's really at the end, when it's done, it's about nothing.
But it wants to be about something.
Oh, it definitely wants to be. It tries so hard. And there's some serious things going on in the movie if you think about it, especially between Jack Nicholson and Paul Rudd. And they're sort of almost like really just glossed over. But I mean, what Jack Nicholson's character—he's very a diabolical SOB.
Yeah.
If you really sit down and think about that, you're like, wow, some father you are.
Yeah, but none of it, you're right. I mean, none of it, it has a lot of promise, but none of it comes into focus.
Not at all. I'm dumbfounded.
Are you near a computer, Jerry?
Yes, I am.
Could you look up for me, I meant to do it before we got on the air, but I was pressed for time. Can you look up for me, there's articles about the missing 17 minutes of 2001 and what is included in that footage?
Yeah, let me go. I think it's at the Wrap is the closest place.
Yes.
I got it, so let me go.
The big news, movie news this week, is that in a salt mine, I believe in Utah, they discovered 17 minutes of deleted footage from 2001. This was footage that Kubrick cut from the movie, claiming that it made the film too long and slow-paced.
Let me see where they found it exactly. What the exact site? If they give, let me see. A Kansas salt mine. Vault.
Kansas. That's what I thought. Okay, Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So.
And
yeah.
The footage includes some additional footage of the Dawn of Man sequence, a scene in which Dave Bowman searched for a replacement antenna part in storage, and a scene where Hal severs radio communication between the Discovery and Frank Pohl's pod, as well as shots of Pohl's spacewalk before he's killed.
Okay. So that amounts up to about 17 minutes of footage that Kubrick cut from the film.
Right.
It was thought, I'm certain, like a lot of footage that Kubrick cut from his movies, vanished forever.
Right.
But it's been found perfectly preserved in the salt mine, which they keep a lot of stuff in these salt mines. I was sitting with my friend the other week, and we were watching something on the salt mines, and mm-hmm. and they were preserving tons of media, and they had all the seasons of Friends, and my friend and I were laughing about it. And I said, "Well, what do they keep in the pepper mines? Like all the lower run stuff?" They say, "Yeah, we keep Friends in the salt mines. We keep Joey in the pepper mines." You know? but they, I mean, it's a common practice. So the question is, as exacting and meticulous as Kubrick was about all aspects of his films, controlling he was about how they were viewed, and how they were marketed and blah, blah, blah. He definitely didn't want this footage seen. So this morning, as part of the Kubrick series, we interviewed Mr. Kubrick's assistant of 34 years, Tony Fruin, started on 2001 with Kubrick and was very close personal friends with him, as well as his assistant. And I think this is like the first word from the Kubrick camp concerning the discovery of the 17 minutes of footage. I think we've got this exclusively. So hang on. This calls for some theme music. Hang on.
It definitely calls for theme music.
This is a world exclusive right here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, here is what Mr. Fruin had to say about that found footage.
I'm sure you read in the news just last week concerning 2001 that they've discovered 17 minutes of footage that he removed in a salt mine, I think, in Kansas or something.
Utah or something.
Yeah, that's perfectly preserved. Now, he wouldn't want that to be seen, would he? He cut it out for a reason.
Yeah. Well, no, he probably wouldn't. But, you know, you then have this thing of well, you know, Stanley really now belongs to history, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And I think you owe it to history you know, I don't think you should recut it into the film, but, I mean, it should certainly be available for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, a great man dies and thinks, well, I don't want any of my letters or my diary ever to reach public gaze, but... You know, one does have a duty to history as well.
Okay. So that's one take from someone close to the family. You think it'll come out in Blu-ray supplemental? You think Warner's will do that? Aaron, what do you think?
I think I think it'll be when I heard this news, I said, "Well, they're the new supplement for the new Blu-ray." I never expected or would even want it to be reinstated. It should be a supplement, and I think it has to be a supplement because since this is news and people now know it, you know, if that Blu-ray comes out and doesn't have it, it'll be, you know, people will be disappointed. The demand for it is just too much that people want to see it, so it has to be a supplement. So, and I'm sure Warner will do it, present it, and Warner's is probably next to Criterion. They are the best with their DVD catalog, so DVD Blu-ray catalog. So I'm sure they will put it in a proper historical context and say, this is what this was, but Stanley didn't feel it, and so forth. And it'll be a supplement. It'll be a fun supplement. It'll be fun.
It'll definitely be fun. How much, let me ask you this, guys, how many other films of his do you think there's footage like this? This is quite a shock.
Here's something in that, because everyone assumed that he destroyed everything that was deleted from his films, but I read the interview with Jon Harlan, and he said that he has the deleted pie fight scene from Strangelove in his vault, his personal vault.
Mm-hmm.
He's never going to let it see the light of day as long as he's living.
Right.
I would imagine he possibly has the deleted ending from The Shining as well, which would be the brass ring for Kubrick movie fans, I would think. I mean, as oft as that's been spoken about and salivated over, I mean, people would love to see that. I think that they are probably still in existence.
I'm of a little different mind or theory on this. I mean, and of course, this is all speculation. I can understand, I don't find it too mind blowing that someone found the 2001 footage or that Jon Harlan has the Strangelove footage. But I do think, particularly after 2001, when Kubrick really took over control of everything that he did, it wouldn't surprise me if particularly the Shining footage was truly destroyed. Because by that time, I think Kubrick was pretty much in control of every aspect. So the Shining footage, while that would be the holy grail, it wouldn't surprise me if that stuff was destroyed.
That is possible, but you're dealing with thousands of prints that they physically cut out after delivery. And then, you know, obviously he had masters of things. I don't know. But then again, I don't know why people keep things in vaults if they never want it to be seen anyway. Why does Jerry Lewis keep The Day the Clown Cried if he never wants it to be seen and he doesn't want to discuss it?
Right.
Why not just destroy it? Aaron, you want to hang on for Tron, and then we'll get together and talk in between? Actually, Aaron did an interview for us that we're playing later on in the show. And what could be better for Christmas time than a conversation with a childhood friend of John Wayne Gacy?
they always go hand in hand with me every year.
You know what?
Off the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
I just realized this is like our holiday show for all intents and purposes, and somehow I saved this interview for this show. It's fascinating, but. So let's get to our first interview. Tron Legacy, the big news this weekend. It finished the weekend in first place. And we'll talk a little bit about the movie, too, after this interview segment. So we thought it would be a nice idea to invite to the show one of the stars of the original Tron, that groundbreaking movie from 1982. And she also happens to be a co-star in Caddyshack.
That's right.
One of the ultimate comedy classics. That's celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. So, I mean, she's integral part of these two classic films that mean so much to so many people around the world. And she has a very interesting story to tell, and she's telling it in a series of three books, the first of which is a immaculately collected coffee table volume that she's looking to release in the summer. And then she's going to tell us about her other works as well and how she got into the business. This is Cindy Morgan. Enjoy it, guys.
Jamie, I wanted to become a mechanical engineer, freaked out, mm-hmm. got a little scared, went to Northern Illinois, got a degree in English, got rid of my stammer, somehow became a movie star. I said, you got this great big brain. Why don't you make some good use of it? Read the magazines, you know, look like those girls. Well, I dropped a few IQ points in the eyes of other people, but I became an actress. I was an engineer and then, you know, got into trying. I'm knowing the whole interview. You want to break in here and ask me a question?
I will, yes. Actually, that's exactly where I was going to start. What was the impetus for you to pursue the path of acting as a career?
Well, initially, as I said, I wanted to be, I was accepted to the Illinois Institute of Technology, which is the Midwest kind of version of MIT. And the reason was I wanted a degree in mechanical engineering. My dad had been a plant manager and fled Europe before World War II and went as far as he could with his education, a year and a half of high school. Brilliant man. He had two wonderful skills. Mm. He worked well with people and because he listened. And he also understood how things work. He couldn't be a designer, but he became a test equipment builder. He had remarkable aptitudes. And I wanted to do that for my dad. And then when I went to the open house, it was four girls and all guys. And I went, and I had come from an all-girls Catholic school, 12 years of Catholic school, and the last four were all girls. And I wasn't ready. I hadn't dated. And you know, when you see the book, everybody goes, oh, everybody says they're a nerd. Check me out. I mean, look, seriously. I mean, you know, when you see the photos that I have for the first book, it's a coffee table book, you'll see that. It came from the deeper reaches of my psyche who never got a chance to do that. Mm-hmm, and when I was cornered, I'm talking about Caddyshack now, when I was cornered by the producers because of the fact that I had a background in technology, because I ran camera and sound and was an FCC licensed sound engineer, somebody tried to correct my wiki page and said they don't license sound engineers. And I wanted to say, yeah, have you talked to the FCC? And were you turning on the tower at the Hancock Center when I was 24? Because that's what we had to have. I'm not sure my license covered that, but I was doing it. So, the reason I got into acting was because I was the radio personality. Even though I had done broadcasting in Rockford, I did the weather very badly. I did the commercials. I did weather in Milwaukee. I was fine and comfortable with camera, but they said, no, you're the radio person. You're the tech. And I went, sure. I said, fine. And I said, I was doing morning drive in Chicago. I was running my own board, and I was making $135 a week, and I was pulling numbers. Mm. And I was working for the Cadillac record people, the Trash Checker record people. I'm sure you've heard of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, all right, and I went out to L.A., and thank God I got an Irish Spring commercial right away that paid my bills, and in 8 months, I had Caddyshack. Now, I didn't bother to tell anybody I didn't have any acting experience, but I went into my agent's office and pulled the resumes of the actors I recognized, flipped them over and saw who they were studying with. I went, all right, if I don't learn anything, at least I'll have something to talk about in the auditions.
So how did you know that if you had really not given it any kind of thought beforehand, or if it wasn't a major goal of yours beforehand, how did you know that you could do it, or did you?
Well, acting since I was a little kid. I come from my family comes from the rural part of from Holland, where storytelling is a lost art. Storytelling, mm-hmm. you know, you go back hundreds of years. Certainly, there were no computers, no internet, no radio stations. And many people didn't read, past the before the 1600s. But storytelling was how the message came through. And there's something to that. And my family comes from a rural part of southern Poland where storytelling was still very much alive. And you can bring it to life. And it has so many facets. You can do it on the radio. You can do it as an actor. You can do it as a writer. You can do it as a speaker. And the most important thing is to know your story, believe your story, and have passion for it. If you're lying, the audience knows it.
From top to bottom on a film set, every role that people fulfill on a film set, they're all assistant storytellers.
Oh, my gosh, yes. The first person I say hello to in the morning is not the director. It's the lighting guy. And mm-hmm. and I make sure my crew, you know, I tell my lighting people, my crew, I'll stand for you as long as you want. Whatever you need, let me know. I'm not placating them. I'm letting them know that I will be there when they need me, because mm-hmm. they can make or break you.
Right.
They're
right.
the ones. They're the real unsung heroes.
I agree. And when you're in front, you said that you were comfortable in front of a camera.
Sure.
When you got in front of that movie camera for that first time, was there a learning curve involved? Because you have to behave in front of a camera.
Sure. Now my first experience was in radio. Now, when I went to college, you know, and I told you the story, I had a stammer, and I ended up in a speech class. I don't know if it was an elective I chose or because they put me there, but I was in that class. I didn't go to Illinois Institute of Technology. I went to Northern Illinois, mm-hmm. and I was a terrible speaker, but I was a good writer. My first assignment was, I want you to teach us how to make something. And with my unique point of view, I went, all right. And I stood up, and with a complete cold eye, I said, the assembly and disassembly of your basic squirt gun. And I continued to read. And the audience, and I had my nose buried in my script, but they just cracked up. And that was the first time in my life a professor said, come here. Now, my grades were good, but the professor said, come here. This is what you should do. Major in communications, which at the time was a combination of three things. It was the theory of speech writing, what it is to learn your audience and find that common denominator and tell your story to them. Communication isn't talking. Communication is getting your message across. All this. One of the second parts was broadcasting. I learned to run camera and sound. And the other part was more speech writing. So I got a good overall view, and I was lucky enough. I shouldn't tell this to Northern, but I rarely went to school. I joined the sorority with the best test file on campus and held three jobs. Two at the student station, camera, and worked at the television. I'm making tea while I'm talking to you. I hope that's okay.
That's fine.
I ran camera, and my first day on radio, and that's what you're asking, my first day on radio, my first day broadcasting, my arms went numb, completely numb. But I got over it and went into broadcasting. And then on camera, my first day on camera was the Jerry Lewis Telethon in Rockford, Illinois. I had been doing radio, and I was able to do radio and television and station. And they put me on camera, and it was my first day. Here's our new weather girl. Hello, how are you? Cindy's going to take your call. And I picked up the call, and it was a man, you know, purportedly giving a pledge. And his exact words were, I'm going to cut off your arms and legs, and I'm going to put you out and back in the Albertsons parking lot in the trash can. And I said, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. That was my
Wow.
Luckily, we haven't had that many problems. You know, the situation, you know, I 99% of the folks I meet are wonderful, and he was just mm-hmm. trying to be playful. But I take it extremely seriously. I have a strict no-psycho policy. Somebody misbehaves, red flags go flying, I make a report. There is no more room for, oh, he had a hard life. So have I. Mm. Knock it off.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about...
Please do, stop me from talking. I'll give a lecture series and they'll never get a word in.
No, that's great. That is terrific. I love hearing you. But in terms of Caddyshack, you're working with, from top to bottom, just a comedic powerhouse of a cast.
Oh, yeah.
Did that translate into a fun experience actually shooting the film?
Well, let me describe fun to you. You sound like a tech. Am I wrong?
I'm actually not technology minded.
Are you a sports guy or a tech guy? Would you say?
I'm neither. I'm kind of an artist type.
Okay. Well, okay. That's a good. Okay. That is your field. When you are working with other artists, wherever that situation would be? Do you ever find yourself in that position when you're, do you work up to the level of your opponent, and does your art get much better?
Oh, yes. That's as it should
all
be.
All right.
Yes.
When you work up to the level of a better opponent, your work gets better. It's a fight to the finish. It's the hardest work you'll ever do in your life. But
yeah.
It will also be the best work you'll ever do in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So fun, maybe. I had to learn about who I was. They created the character of Lacey by pushing me into a corner, and I came out swinging. I didn't know I had that. I wasn't rude. When they sent the photographer from Playboy, I said, and John Peters was saying, he's admitted it, so I don't have to back off from this story. He said, he called me between takes and said, your film will never work again. And I said, so be it, John, but now I'm clearing the set. Because I knew who belonged there because I run camera. I run sound. And I said, and they were hiding everywhere. And I said, look, we got a job to do today, and we're burning daylight. So I want to see four men. They had the old cameras. I said, I want to see that focus puller, that director of photography, Harold Ramis, the director, and that actor. Until then, I got all day. Take your time.
Hmm.
You should have heard the swearing I heard. But I just sat there, and we got the job done. But that was the day Lacey was born. Because
wow.
The scene, in my mind, was rewritten Lacey Makes Love with Danny to Lacey Makes Love to Danny.
Mm-hmm.
She
mm-hmm.
took charge. She took power. And they did me a favor. I should be sending John a thank you note.
Tron. I have to ask about Tron, obviously.
Please.
Tell me about the... Because, obviously, Tron was a major stepping stone in terms of the technology of filmmaking and what it's blossomed into today.
It was
today.
The technology of filmmaking. But to me, it was, I got a script. Now, I knew the language of technology, but these words were new. I had not worked with computers, but I didn't have a problem with that. I did have a problem, however, with lines with Steven. I would say, now, Steven, I cannot say, oh, Tron, I knew there wasn't a circuit built that could hold you. All my friends are coming to this movie. And Steven said, you try to pick a fight with the writer who's also the director. Just try. But I'm proud of that line now, and I'll tell you why. Because as hard as I tried, I choked on the line. And to this day, the audience laughs. And I'm very fond of that line because I love the audience. You cannot fool them. They know. And I feel like, you know, I knew 5 years ago, and I feel like Tinkerbell. Clap your hands and bring her back to life. Well, they did.
But did you feel, on Tron, did you feel that it was kind of so new that did you have a sense of, you know, what are we doing? Is this going to work?
No. No. I never worry about that. I never worry about that because it always works. It always works because... In this case, like I said, storytelling is to news reporting is to new writing is to. I knew it would work because I had actors. You've been on sound stages. They're giant warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing there, and in this case, it was a block warehouse, and we were in. But I found the reality in the other actors' eyes, and if you commit to the scene, it will be there. I pull a piece of myself. My particular, you know, way of doing this is I won't lie. I won't lie because I just can't. I just don't want to. I'll find something in myself that will bring me to that point and amplify it and make that real. So I wasn't worried about the technology having not been used before. I would do my job to the best of my ability, and it will be real. But the only time I raised a question is when I came in. I stopped reading the script because I went, this is just, just tell me what I'm doing today. And let's live. And I did that on Caddyshack too, but for very different reasons. They were ad-libbing all of that. So I would shout out, all right, what are we doing today? And there was a black riser of sorts. And on top of that was something that looked like a banquet table covered with black felt. And I said, And Steven Lesberger said, okay, Morgan, you and Box Lightner are on the Solar Sailor. You're crossing the game sea. Go. Morgan, you're flying the ship.
Mm.
I said, all right, I just got to ask. What the hell are you talking about? there's nothing here. I got to break in, you know, with all due respect, there's nothing here. And he showed me the beautiful Sidney graphics. He showed me what it would look like. He showed me where it was going so that I could see it in my mind's eye. And I walked up to the banquet table, and I saw where the direction was headed. And I looked down in front of me, and I saw the only thing that was real to me, and that was a soundboard.
Mm.
And he said, whatever you do, the Disney artists will put in. And in my mind, I saw a soundboard that somehow was moving this forward.
Let me ask you just for some brief impressions of some of the great people that you have worked with. Starting with Jeff Bridges, obviously we've been talking about Jeff Bridges forever. He's always been known as one of our most underrated actors, and he's finally kind of getting the credit that he deserves. He's just magnificent. Tell me about that experience.
He's a love. He's passionate about what he does. He believes in what he does. If he doesn't believe in it, he isn't going to do it. He works hard. He comes in prepared, and he's just full of passion in life. And I adore Jeff. Can you imagine being in a movie where you get to, well, I will say imagine you're, all right, as a guy, you're in a movie and you get to kiss the two most beautiful female leads you've ever seen. How would you be?
That would be heaven.
Yes, it was a little slice of heaven.
Mm.
You didn't get that take? No problem, I got all day.
Bill Murray.
Oh, another sweetie. Billy and I didn't have a lot of scenes directly together, but we're both from Chicago, and he saw all the carousing on the set, and I got to tell you, you either became part of the madness or you got washed away, so I wasn't part of it. Billy pulled me on the side one day, and he said, look, you know, take it easy. You're not like these guys. Just ease it. Like a big brother put his arm around me, you know, and you know, Billy is Billy. A lot of those characters are from him, but I have the greatest admiration and the greatest, I mean, these are men I love and will love forever because of who and what they are.
The relationship you had with Chevy Chase was strained, I heard, and it's not the first time I've heard that from his
I would
co-star.
Say strained would be, I'd say it would be more accurate to say it was volatile. But it also worked.
Yeah.
Chevy is a genius. No two ways about it. I was a new kid on the block, and he was going to show me how to run a scene. I was well aware of the fact that when that camera rolls, it's an even playing field. And if you dump a bottle of oil on my back, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay right in that scene. For example, that piano playing scene, that wasn't in the script. It wasn't rehearsed. It wasn't even discussed ahead of time. Harold Ramis said, come over here and sit down next to Chevy. I said, why? It's hot. We got stuff to do. You're burning daylight. What's the problem? I mean, I come from a broadcast background, not from these guys. And he said, just do it. Just say, sing me a love song. I said, all right, I'll do it. I'll play along. So I look at Chevy and I say, sing me a love song.
I was born to love you. I was born to lick your face. I was born to rub you, but you were born to rub me first.
And out of the corner of my right eye, I see the goddamn camera light on. And I went, you sons of bitches are filming this, aren't you? Now, I want you to watch my eyes next time you see the scene. You'll see you'll see the recognition sink in. You'll see it very clearly. And I went, all right, you son of a bitch. I had a big wad of gum in my mouth, and I blew it in his face, and that was the button on the scene.
Mm. Wow.
But I also will tell you this. Chevy set me up very well when we did our scenes on the porch because he played straight to me. He set me up well. So it was a love-hate thing, but love and hate are closer than you might realize. And I think that gave us the passion we needed to do those scenes.
It absolutely did. And listening to you talk about your time, you know, your career, and the different kind of challenges and opportunities that you've had, and obviously you're writing these books, and so you're reflecting on what these experiences mean for you. I mean,
no, yes and no. I'll say what they mean for me, but I hope to hit that human common denominator where everybody went to 12 years of Catholic school, everybody had a Sister Francis, everybody had this, and everybody went through in their life a challenge. And from those challenges, you became, well, you either lived or died.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you lived. Everybody did the same. And I'm going to handle these serious subjects directly. I'm going to dedicate the book to Doug Kenny, if you know who he is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The last line on the first page is, I paraphrase the actual expression, and I said, history is written for the victors. Congratulations, Doug Kenny. Your movie's a hit.
I guess that's what I'm asking. What has this journey in this profession, what has it taught you about yourself? Is it that you are a survivor?
Well, you ask me on certain days, and I will disagree with that. But it depends on if you're asking my head or my heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The long run is I intend to survive. But all the things that scared me growing up, I'm going to learn about them, and I'm going to go through them. I have 1,700 behind-the-scenes images, which I have the rights to for the first book, which will be a coffee table book called From Catholic School to Caddyshack.
Mm-hmm.
And that one will be based on Caddyshack. That will be followed on the heels of that with some – I'm trying to use the title, Everyone I Know is Nuts, a Cindy Morgan story. And number three is going to be Hat Trick. I went as far as I could as a disc jockey morning drive in Chicago, as far as you can go. When you don't do things that have nothing to do with your job, I hope you know what I mean, as an actor, you might get held back.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't shoot the nude scene for Playboy. I don't have a problem with Playboy. I have a problem with bullies.
Right.
And so now I get to do what I've always wanted to do, and that's tell stories. But tell stories, it would be great if I could take the reader and say, come here, take a look at what I saw. You're not going to believe this. You know,
mm-hmm.
And come on in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the coffee table book, I'm working with a couple of my friends, and he said, look at that. All the actors are running toward camera. There's a three-story fireball, and now you can see the smoke, and there's one figure there. Who's that looking at the smoke? And I said, that would be me. I apparently am the only actor who's not running trying to get FaceTime on camera. I'm the only one going, am I the only one who saw a three-story fireball? Tomorrow, they're going to paint it green, they're going to blow it up again, and I'm going to be far enough away from these guys have got gasoline. I am getting the hell out of here. So this will be a first-hand account of what it was like doing arguably one of the funniest movies ever made with one of the most brilliant casts. We were struck by comedy lightning. You cannot repeat what was done because you can't plan this kind of improvisation. That
mm-hmm.
that's where the movie magic either happens or it doesn't. And then from there, I wasn't called for a long time because I wouldn't shoot the nude scene for Playboy. My billing, which was and introducing Cindy Morgan as Lacey Underall, was going to make me the next Bo Derek. That was taken from me, breaking my contract, which was illegal, but nobody stood up for me. My agent, who I called, said, honey, you're not a doe-eyed girl from the Midwest. Handle it. Well, I did, and I came back and fired him. And sat cooling my heels at William Morris for the next year and a half, having more lunch with the male agents than auditions.
Yeah.
Then Disney came calling. This is how it happened. Disney didn't call me to meet with the casting director. Disney didn't call me to meet with anybody. They put me right with the director and with Jeff Bridges on tape. And I'm like, okay, I'll go along with this gag. I've seen more unusual situations. I got the job because before Caddyshack, I was in a comedy improv class and dating an actor who took me to lunch where he had a job in a cartoon. And I was listening, and I'm like, okay, cartoon sounds like fun, but I was eating my lunch. Well, that was Tron. He was out. I was in 2 years later.
I still have power. Sark doesn't know that.
Leave me alone. We failed.
We're only going to fail if we give up. Now, come on, look. The wall.
You brought me back. Oh, why did you bring me back?
I need your help. Come on.
you go to various conventions and things, I
oh,
know.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of terrific fan interaction. Tell me about their enthusiasm and your encounters with them.
99% is just, I mean, I'm exhausted at the end of the day because I hear the most wonderful stories about, and I can tell you, I'm 99% right. I can see a fan coming and I can tell you Caddyshack or Tron. In fact, I keep my Caddyshack pictures on one end of the table and my Tron pictures on the other end just to keep the peace, you know, because this is the first year because of the crossover, because of Caddyshack's 30th anniversary and mm-hmm. because of the Tron legacy, the fans have been so warm and wonderful, and it's almost a gift that, you know, it would have been nice to have the part in the film. I really could use the money. There isn't much we get because, you know, we don't get money from the DVDs. Mm-hmm. We don't get money from anything that was included in the cable, what wasn't included in the original contract. So very little comes from that. But
yeah.
You know, yeah, but what we do get, but so that would have been nice. But can I tell you how much cooler it is? I mean, could you imagine somebody coming up to you and saying, "I heard a podcast you did 30 years ago, and it affected my life so that it changed everything." The Caddyshack fans, it's a lifestyle. The
mm-hmm.
Tron fans, it's more of a spiritual. Attraction. It's a very different mindset, but they say the most wonderful things, and the coolest thing has happened. Because of the internet, the fans have a voice.
Yes.
Because of the internet, the fans are making the decisions. And when I heard the support come, I can't tell you what it feels like to have somebody say, "That meant something to me."
Okay, that is Cindy Morgan from Tron and Caddyshack, and you can read more about it. She's working on 3 books, and you can read more about them and about her at her website, cindy-morgan.com. All right, guys, you're back up.
Yeah, wow. That was awesome.
That is all you really can say for that interview.
I don't know how we're going to top that, but.
You know what? I tell you something. I'm having problems with the next interview. It's a really large sized file, and I can't understand why. It's 20 minutes of talking. But,
right.
So while you guys do your little roundtable thing together, I have to find a way to decrease the size of this file so I can upload it. We could finish off with the childhood friend of John Wayne Gacy, as is befitting the holidays for the show.
Oh yeah, I mean, when I think holidays, I always think of John Wayne Gacy.
Well, not only that, but I am a little startled. I honestly thought when she asked the question of Jamie, I could have sworn he's a sports person.
What? You know me better than that, don't you?
I mean,
I talk to you every single day, Aaron. I like sports fine, but
yeah, that's why I figured go with sports.
Over technology, I'd go with sports. I strike you as a jock type.
Yeah. Well, is that something like a jock? What is Barry?
Now, how vision impaired are you? I mean, you have seen me. You know what I look like.
What does Barry play? Does Barry play tennis?
You know what? I don't want to know what Barry plays, but I can only imagine.
Oh God, we've really just gone down on that
Barry,
one.
Barry strikes me as a tennis guy.
So is he. What?
Barry strikes me as a tennis guy.
Maybe.
Possibly.
Or maybe golf. I don't know.
Yeah. Why are we talking about this?
Yeah, really. Why are we talking about this?
Anyway,
so what is
Tron
our roundtable about, Jamie?
I'm trying to decrease the size of this file, so why don't you tell us a little bit about Tron Legacy, Jerry? Did you see it in IMAX 3D or 2D or what?
No, I just saw 3D. I didn't see the IMAX 3D. I just saw
okay.
3D.
Well, how's the – I must admit, I purposely kind of like not, seeing any leaked clips or any clips they, you know, to get the buzz going. And the other thing I also did, I purposely – you know, I never even listened to any of the samples of the Daft Punk.
Right. I didn't either. But I hardly ever watch any of these clips for any of these movies when they come on because I see the trailer. I saw the trailer in the movie theaters a bunch of times, but I don't really, as I've gotten older, I don't know. Even for the trailers I really want to see, I wait till they come in the theater, you know, to watch them. But
How's the score? Just let me ask some. How's the Daft Punk score?
It's fine. I mean, here's the thing. I don't have strong opinions of this film one way or the other. I know there's a lot of fanboys just bashing it. I saw Tron. I remember my mom took me and a friend to see it when it came out in theaters, and that's the last time I saw it. And that was, you know, obviously a very long time ago. It was, you know, for what it was fine. I remember when The Matrix came out, a lot of people were referencing Tron. I was like, oh, yeah, the movie and the video game from back way when. The score is fine. I could take or leave the movie. I didn't go in with any expectations because I had none. I mean.
Well, here's this first question because, I mean, I think fanboys are finally realizing, or sadly realizing that even those of us who like the original Tron, I'll be the first one to tell you, it has an impenetrable plot. And so the same thing I'm sure is true here. It's all about sight, sound, and set pieces. So which set piece is the one that you're like, okay, that was worth seeing?
Well, I think obviously the light cycle races. I mean, there is a great analogy that the film that is being compared to the most, I know this is The Phantom Menace, which is a film that's based around basically a pod race, if you will.
Right.
And that's really, let's be very honest, I think that's what it was. And you know, he's like, oh, I have to make a story around this, or attempt to make a story, I think is the right word, around this sequence. So you have that. I think you have all these, it's like the light cycle races, the disc fighting that, you know, from the original film, that is, they've amped up, obviously, they had the money and the special effects. And, you know, look, it is what it is. It's an experience. You watch it. Now, I just read somewhere that a lot of it wasn't shot in 3D, but actually IMAX.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of, like, 3D that comes at you. So whatever that really means. It is what it is. And I said the exact same thing about the Transformers sequel. I don't know what people are expecting. I honestly have to say, I don't know. You know, like Transformers. It's a movie about robots that can change into planes or cars and vice versa. There's not much else there. You're paying for that. Here, this is a movie where it's really the effects, and there's a sense of nostalgia among Gen Xers, I guess. And the generation afterwards, I may add, too, really love this film, the original film. But I don't know, can't imagine going into a film like this with really high expectations.
Well, let me ask you this, and you know, we've all talked about it, and there's a general consensus. You know, Jeff Bridges is one of our finest actors, underrated actors. He's finally getting the accolades. And that was kind of the thing about the first Tron, is that, you know, as impenetrable as that plot was, Jeff Bridges was able to etch out a character that you could identify with and like and follow, and that was your through line. So how is Jeff Bridges, considering what this is, Tron Legacy, and it's also a, you know, ridiculous plot, I'm assuming. How does he do with all the
artillery?
He's
playing Obi-Wan. He's playing Obi-Wan meets the dude.
Obi-Wan
meets the dude.
Obi-Wan meets the dude. That's priceless. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's what he's playing.
Well, there's something zen about both characters.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, like I said, it's not like something you, like I said, I'm not like one of these people that has like high expectations for this. So I just go in. I know a lot of like the reviews I read beforehand of the on the fan sites and the movie blogs were just like, my God, you would think that, I did not realize until Comic-Con that Tron was so important. I had no idea, but I live in my own bubble and my own vacuum. You know, I don't know what's important to most people and what isn't, but it's, you know, is it a great film? No, it's not, but you can't really take it that seriously. The thing is, the Matrix films really took this to where it could go, and cyberpunk science fiction in the 80s and 90s took this as doing all this, did all this. There's nothing new here. If you're looking for that content, like cyberspace. There's nothing new. It doesn't add anything to that. I think maybe that's what some people are disappointed in. That there's really
this is what Tron Legacy was aiming for. It was aiming to be kind of the next must-see visual and sensory kind of experience,
right?
Like Avatar was the same weekend last year.
I was trying to capitalize
on an Avatar kind of.
Yeah,
first.
It's not bad. I don't know how it could be. They obviously want to bring in young. I know a lot of kids, little kids, are really interested in seeing that, and I think they might like it. But it could be also that they. I'll never forget what Elvis Mitchell said about the Phantom Menace. Are kids, little kids, really interested in the dispute about trade routes? So it brings in that. Now there are some great set pieces like the Phantom Menace, but there's not a lot there. But I, you know, like I said, I don't go into this high expectations. I guess there's a very high expectations for like a lot of people who grew up with the original and really loved it.
This is always whenever one of these reboots or remakes or whatever you want to call it.
I guess this is a sequel. Wouldn't this be
a
sequel?
You know, sequel. I mean. Yes, it is technically, I guess it is a sequel, but let's be honest. This is a reboot of a property. You know, basically it's what it is. And I think what happens whenever they do this to these cult items that have this rabid following, you know, I honestly think the fanboys are the ones to blame because they are the ones who really put up unreasonable expectations for something to follow. And they never want to really be... even for a moment, objective and think about the things that they treasure. I mean, the original Tron had no story. It was just sight and sound and music. But it was something you grew up in. I mean, all the stuff about grids and all this stuff being de-res back in 82. I mean, I doubt 8-year-olds were that interested in grids, you know.
You're right, Aaron. You're right, and it's really interesting. Because in my family, I went with my mom to see it. I understood a lot of the computer technology. Now you guys remember this is very primitive compared to now. Primitive, but I understood a lot of the terms and everything they're using about, and that made to me it made sense because for like 2 or 3 years in elementary school we were using computers and everything. So a lot of that made sense to me. But you're right. Either fanboys do come in with these expectations, and you saw what Michelle Gondry, in regards to comic book fans, said in The Guardian this week. He thought they're a bunch of fascists because they have this particular view of what they think the story should be, and it's not, you know, that doesn't really put people in seats necessarily.
No, I mean that's something the studios need to realize. I really despise the Comic-Con mentality. Because basically you're catering to a niche audience that is going to show up no matter the quality of the film.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're showing up to Tron Legacy because the word Tron is in the title.
Mm-hmm.
So you really never have to worry about fanboys' approval. And you really shouldn't. It should always be about the crossover. And so, I mean, that's why I kind of like Michelle Gondry doing
I think it's a great idea. Great
because
concept.
He's going to take the piss out of it.
Yeah. Well,
what's
that like about Aronofsky doing Wolverine?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's
going to be the first X-Men movie I see in a theater since the first one. I have not seen any of the X-Men sequels or the Wolverine film in theaters. I've seen them on TV, and I've been underwhelmed by all of them. But Aronofsky's doing Wolverine? Okay, I will watch that.
Yeah, I mean, I was explaining to my mom after watching Black Swan how that he's basically the perfect director because Wolverine is basically an Aronofsky character. Whether anyone wants to admit it or not, he's the perfect Aronofsky. He's got issues with his body. He wants to be perfect. He's a mutant. He's perfect for Aronofsky. I mean, I don't think he's had a better
what about a Cronenberg
character?
A Cronenberg Wolverine.
That's another one. And that's a great point that you bring up, Jamie, because I think Aronofsky's obviously Cronenberg is a humongous influence on him.
I did see True Grit. I saw the other Jeff Bridges movie. And it's The Dude Meets the Duke.
Oh, that's quite a combo.
That's good. Wow.
That's awesome, yeah. I mean, that is
I'm sure that's how they pitched it to him. They're like, it's the dude meets the Duke. He said, yeah, I'll do it. True Grit is terrific. Coen Brothers, they're, you know, these four films in 4 years that they've done have been pretty spectacular. They've really matured, you know, and gone into kind of a whole new level of filmmaking. While I still think their last film, A Serious Man, is the best of these four, True Grit is pretty terrific. And one way I feel it's better than No Country for Old Men as a Western is that it's a Western minus, it's really an old-fashioned Western minus all that existential, late in the film existential mumbo-jumbo that kind of gummed up the last 20 minutes of No Country for Old Men. This is a straightforward, old-fashioned Western, great character. But what is interesting, there is a very, very theme of time passing that is always percolating throughout the action and the story. And it leads to a last line of the film that really is kind of a profound and really startling, in that you realize the last line of the film pretty much sums up what you've been seeing in a way that you weren't thinking about. Mm-hmm. And Briggs is terrific as usual. Matt Damon is hilarious as LaBeef. Haley Steinfeld is terrific. Right now, I haven't seen Animal Kingdom. Unfortunately, I missed it when it was here for a week. But of the performances I've seen that are talked about for supporting actress, I think it's a showdown between Haley Steinfeld and Melissa Leo. Those seem to be the front runners. Brolin is good, although Brolin does something interesting. I was talking to my sister after I saw the film. I go, Brolin has a knack, and I don't mean this in any way glibly, but he has a knack for playing characters who are dim, but also surprisingly sinister.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that kind of seems to be something he's good at, is playing dim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between this and W, you know, he's very good at playing guys who are not too bright.
Right.
And he's very good here. So,
okay,
I mean,
I'm asking for trouble here. Hang on, Aaron. I'm asking for trouble here.
What are you asking?
A fourth person on the line. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Dino.
What's going down? How are you doing?
Not bad.
Yeah? Hi, Aaron. What's going on with you?
Hey, what's up? Hey, Dean, maybe you can answer this question of some of the movies coming out
sure.
for the holiday season. If you had your choice between Blue Valentine and Rabbit Hole, which film would you see? The one about the deterioration of a marriage or of a family falling apart after the death of a child?
I'd run to go see Blue Valentine, I think, because I just adore those two actors. And, of course, Rabbit Hole, a friend of mine saw Rabbit Hole, so it's very reliable. It's a friend that actually worked on Winter's Bone, the director... Richard Sandler, who did all of the 8mm stuff in Winter's Bone, he says that he thinks Rabbit Hole is one of the best movies of the year, and he said that easily Kidman gives his favorite performance of the year. So, but even with that said, you know, I'm definitely going to watch both of them. I would go to Blue Valentine first. But I wouldn't see them both in the same day, or else, you know.
I think you should see them both on Christmas Day.
If I had the chance, I would
myself.
Do both on Christmas Day.
And at the end of the day, hang myself from the rafters in my basement.
Well, just to show you, just a kind of a reminder of what to be thankful for this holiday season.
So is Blue Valentine supposed to be a modern contemporary version of Revolutionary Road then?
I think it's a little more. From what I understand, it's a little more modern than that. From what I've
it's
what
extremely
I've
improvised too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hearing it's like you know, updated Cassavetes, but even
yeah.
but more.
A lot of it's actually shot in one take.
Mm. Oh wow!
Yeah. That's exactly cool. Why I want to see it, you know, is because, you know, the one thing that's making me nervous about Rabbit Hole is I hear that it's a little stagey.
Well, it's based on a play, isn't it?
Pulitzer Prize winning play. And I say that a couple of reviews up here said that you can basically hear the floorboards on the stage creaking as people are walking through the scenes. So it's like,
Dean, have you moved to Atlanta yet?
No, I was just over here right in front of the Ziegfeld here, the best theater in New York City. I was sitting in the lobby listening to Out of the Cold, listening to the show. And guess what they're playing at the Ziegfeld right now, Jamie?
Don't know.
They're playing in between, you know, they just got Harry Potter out of there. It's a huge theater. It's got like...
It's a very nice theater. I love that theater.
Or whatever, and it's just beautiful. Anyway, in between Harry Potter, which just ended here, and True Grit, which begins in a few days, they're playing The Sound of Music in 35mm, a brand new print, for about 6 days. So,
for the holidays. Okay.
Yeah,
I was like,
that's
all
right. Yeah, exactly.
I thought he was going to say they're showing Foul Play. But
in 70mm.
Yeah, that was
good.
Yeah, 70mm. Yeah,
right.
Definitely.
All right. So you haven't moved to Atlanta yet. Hang on. Before you tell us the date that you're going to move to Orlando, I want to give it a little intro, okay?
That music, it sends chills up my spine. I'm moving tomorrow. The van was loaded up the other night and ready to go for tomorrow. I got to wrap up some things. I'm going to be selling some of my movie posters to a guy up here named Jerry Olinger, who owns one of the premier movie poster stores. I want to leave the town with a little bit of money in my pocket, so, mm-hmm. So I'm taking him a selection of movie posters at 11:30.
Okay.
And then I'm on the road.
Okay, so you heard it here first. Dean is moving from New York City to Atlanta tomorrow. This has been an exclusive report from Blog Talk Radio and Movie Geeks United. I'm Chip Martindale. Good evening.
Good evening, Chip.
Stay classy, Lakeland.
Hey guys, I just had a great, great movie send-off at the Museum of Modern Art. I've been there from 12 o'clock today till about 6. And I went to go see the abstract expressionists, like, you know, Pollock and de Kooning and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was, I'm just going to tell you another thing that was there. There was this... So there's a piano. It's a big room. There's a piano. The piano has a hole cut in the middle of it. The pianist gets under the piano, comes through the hole, and then plays Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Ode to Joy, backwards while walking the piano around this big room. And it was unbelievable. Unbelievable. I sat and watched it twice. But
you know, actually that's as Beethoven intended when he wrote it. I mean, he was
Beethoven,
very specific about it.
It was interesting too, because since he's there, you know, since there was a female and a male who played it, so I watched them both. But since
and the male
there,
was the one that came through the hole?
Oh God.
I'm asking,
how
there's
old,
a male and a female.
How old are you?
I mean, so it's a legitimate question, Dean.
Where was the woman? How did this work?
No, the woman would come, you know, they would do two separate performances, you know. They weren't doing,
oh.
You know, they weren't, you
they
know,
weren't playing together.
Tandem. No,
Okay.
That was great, but then the movie part was really something amazing. And this will be going on at the moment until March. On the sixth floor, they had the Andy Warhol movie. The thing is called Motion Pictures, the exhibit. and it's all of Andy Warhol's movies. Except I didn't see Empire there, but you walk in and they have the full 8 hours of Sleep playing, and then you go around the corner, and there's this huge, huge room that has 15 video monitors, each of them about 8 feet wide and 6 feet tall, each of them playing Warhol's 4-minute screen tests in a loop, okay? And it's just screen tests of the following people, and basically they're just staring into the camera trying to hypnotize you or whatever. So among the people there were that are featured in these films are Susan Sontag, the author, Dennis Hopper, Lou Reed, Nico, Edie Sedgwick, Paul America, another Andy Warhol, satellites, and a few other people. So it's just extraordinary. Okay, and then finally, at the very end of this big room with all of these monitors surrounding you, you see a big open doorway, and there's about, it's like a little movie theater, probably about 100 seats in it, and you can see through the doorway what's playing in there, and it's Andy Warhol's 8-minute movie called Kiss, which is basically a series of couples kissing for 4 minutes, like one thing will end and then the other one will start up and everything. So I sat in there and watched that for about 20 minutes, and then but it was extraordinary. I spent about an hour up there watching some of this stuff. Blowjob was playing. That was another one where it's just you just see a guy sitting there.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't
want to
know what you see.
So, but it's extraordinary. I mean, if you haven't seen any of these Andy Warhol movies, you should just go and check them out. They're not
that Warhol. You know what they say: shoot what you know.
But it was really great.
I just heard they found the missing 17 minutes from Sleep.
Very good. That was classic, Aaron.
Oh,
that was good.
That is good. That is good. That's awesome.
It explains it, from what I understand.
Yeah. But he cut it out because it just made it too slow paced.
It started to drag. People were starting to doze off.
That's even better than the other one. Better than the other joke, Aaron.
They also cut out.
Don't we have an interview to play?
All right. Hey, here's the trailer to the new movie Dear Mr. Gacy, which is now available on DVD. Start any minute now. I promise you.
The year was 1978, when the killing spree of John Wayne Gacy finally came to an end.
He killed 33 times, and his victims were all boys and young men. The county sheriff's deputy made a gruesome discovery in the crawl space beneath a Chicago residence.
Dug up a few days before Christmas, one after another.
The bodies of 28 victims have been recovered, another 5 retrieved from the Des Plaines River.
Authorities have tried on numerous occasions to elicit a detailed confession from Gacy, but he has remained tight-lipped about the crimes ever since his conviction.
I'm going to write a letter to John Wayne Gacy. If I can get information out of him that no one else has been able to, not the police, not the FBI, not even his own wife, I'm going to get inside this guy's head.
Center,
will you accept the charges?
Operator, I accept.
What's up, buddy?
Yeah, who can forget when they received the call from John Wayne Gacy? I mean, that's something that sticks in your mind.
I saved that recording. Okay.
Save it.
I remember when Jamie first called me.
Aaron had a chance to speak to Barry Bocelli, who is the childhood friend of John Wayne Gacy. He also has a book out. about his relationship with Gacy called Johnny and Me, which apparently he mentions many times in the interview.
That's good. No, I believe you should plug it. If you flaunt it, got it. You know what Zero Mostel says in the producers, but okay, whatever.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And that's the, yeah, that, you're right. And here he is. I was trying to think of a joke, but it didn't come quick enough. And here he is speaking about his relationship with Mr. Gacy. Here is Barry Bocelli.
When did you first hear about John Wayne Gacy, and how immediate did you know that, wait, I knew him?
Well, now that is a question that goes right back to the beginning, because Johnny and I grew up as childhood friends when he was 8 and I was 9. 18 and he was 17, my folks moved out to Des Plaines, Illinois, and I have a little card. It says, Johnny and I went down the path together. He went one way, I went the other. And then I came out to Cheyenne, Wyoming in the early 70s after Mom had passed away to work with my family, my brother and sister-in-law. Then I had stayed here until about 75, returned back to Illinois, encountered Johnny the first time. And since that time, of course, he'd really changed. Wasn't the same that I remembered when he was younger. And I had started a project with another roommate of mine to keep my sanity, the fact that I had lost my mom. So I started this project called The White House, and I turned an apartment. Anyways, into it, and one evening, while we were up doing our thing, I was figuring out, because people used to come and visit it, there came a knock at the door. Now, this is about approximately 75, and I said to my partner, what do people come in this late? 9 o'clock in the evening. We don't have this late of people. So he went to open the door, and as he did, I happened to be standing there, and Johnny says to me, this is from your father, this is from me, and hit me in the side of my left side of the face, and I landed on the floor. Well, I had no idea why I was getting hit. It all happened so quickly. And when my roommate was going to throw him over the banister, and I said, no, don't do that. I said, I know he's under probation. So Johnny went a-running. And the next day I called up, it's all in my book called Johnny and Me, the book I pulled out on September 5th of 2008 through Author House that put it together. And in the book I tell you that the next day I called up his mother, Marion, who is very close to me because I used to eat many dinners in her house. She's only 4 doors from my house on the northwest side of Chicago on Monitor and Memorial. Monitor is the street I lived on. Memorial was the next street he lived on. Anyways, I called her up and I said, Marion. She said, oh, I haven't heard from you in some time. I said, this is not a social call. I said, your son hit me last night in the side of my face, and it's all swelled up. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And I says, what is all this about? And still, I didn't get all the thing. The only thing I could figure out, my sister, who's long past, learned through my family that my father was going to give Johnny and Marion, my mother's, all her jewelry. Now, we're talking nice stuff because Dad's in the cocktail lounge. So my sister saw him running down the front steps when they were all at the house. I wasn't allowed to be there. And so she grabbed him and got it back. Well, when my sister called me up and told me this, I went into a rage. I said, is this how my mom gets paid back for her kindness? And so word got to my dad and to Johnny, and Daddy used Johnny to come to my house. And so I told her. Well, that was in 75, and then of course I moved on with my life, and he moved on with what he was doing, and it wasn't great. Believe me, it wasn't, because I didn't know that his mind had turned. I knew that things had happened when we were little kids. And I know that he was hit by a swing from a park that we had gone to, all 15 of us. We used to all hang together back in the 50s, long, long past. You'll never see those lights again. And he went to grab a swing, and it clobbered in front of his forehead, which knocked him out on the ground. And, of course, that ended that little thing, and we took him, put him in a wagon, and carried him home. And I didn't see Johnny for about a week. But knowing Johnny, as I met him in 1950, playing Steal the Bacon on the North Side of Chicago, and putting my hand into his, I remember, and I still this very day, I was right. I said to my friends, let's go meet our new friends, because I saw him walking up the street, and of course my folks was the house where everybody came and sat and drank. And so it was in a hot August evening, and school was out, and so I said, let's go meet him. So as I walked up toward him, I had this funny feeling come across me. He wasn't just a person. There was something about him. He was different. That's all I could tell you. And as I went to put my hand on, I said, hello, and he said, my name is John Wayne Gacy, just like that. And I said, my name is Barry Boschelli. And we grabbed hands, and as I shook, I knew there was something about him. But, of course, who's going to listen to me? And this is all in my mind. So anyways, I wasn't wrong. And we grew up, and we did many things together, as is in my book. You'll read about the junk picking. Of course, we don't call it junk picking. We call it upperpreneurs. And we were the fancy junk pickers because we were choosy what we took from other people's garbage cans. And I think about what I did then. I'm surprised I didn't come down with the disease. But anyways, we did that. And then you'll read about the Christmas caroling that he formed, Johnny, myself, Karen, his sister, and Connie, who is gone now. And we used to go to neighbors, and he had a beautiful voice. He could sing Oh Holy Night and make you cry, and every word of it, believe me. And I've always regretted that with my father's background and politicians and people, Mayor Daley and all the people he knew, I couldn't go to him for favors. I just couldn't. And that'll be a regret that I'll just have to live with the rest of my life. Because I thought to myself sometimes, if I had done that, would that have stopped him, or would that have altered his life in such a way that he never would have ended up the way that we'll never know. We'll just never know. And then
let me ask you this. There's a lot of questions here. When Mr. Gacy got arrested and all the stuff came out, or even when you first met him, that you knew something was different. And,
yes.
But when all that came out and all the notoriety that came with it,
well, I was, at the time, there was a banding by my father. I didn't have no brains. We'll just leave it at that. So I went my way, and my dad went his. Well, I went to his house in 1978 after a number of attempts to try to make peace with my father. Once when I was married, he wouldn't let me say anything in my defense when I said, Dad, I said, why do you always put Johnny before me? He said, because he has more brains than you have. And I said, that's not true. I said, look where Johnny is. That's because he was in prison now in 1980. Look where I am. This was 82 when this went down. And he said, I don't want to hear no more about this. See, he has stuck his neck out in many ways, more ways that I found out later on. Well, then, as he was leaving to get away from me, because the interview was over, I yelled out to him, Dad, and that was a hard thing to do, but anyways, I did, and he turned around and said, what do you want now? I said, I have something that Johnny never had. What? Your blood. And so he didn't talk to me for about 5 years, but that's okay. It hurt me, but I had to move on. Then eventually, up in Fontana, I said to myself more than once, my mom wouldn't want this. I've got to do something about making peace, even if he wants to throw the kitchen sink at me. So I drove down from Fontana, Wisconsin. I was taking care of an estate, and I had called him ahead of time. He said, yeah, I could come, because you just never go to his house unless he says so. He was that kind of a man, very, very organized. And so I got into I knocked on his door, and my stepmother answered me, came inside, and she said, you want to talk to your father? And I said, yes. She said, yes. And I started to talk to him, you know, about trying to get things straightened out. And he would just look at me and say, look, we're not going there no more. I said, I know, but look what's coming down here. Look all the stuff that has happened. Can't we make some kind of a peace? And he said, no. Mm-mm. Anyways, go to the counter. There's a note there. So there was a note from Johnny. And I hadn't seen him since the jewelry episode and him hitting me in the face with his fist from my father and him. And that was in 75. Now this is 78. So I'm afraid to even call him because I don't know what he's going to do to me. So I finally made the decision. I called, and I'm shaking like a leaf. And he says, "What are you shaking for?" Because I'm stuttering. And I said, "Well, it's because I went down to see my father. I haven't seen him in some time." And he said, "Would you like to come out to my house?" And I said, "Where do you live?" "In Norwich, Illinois." So I thought nothing of it. And yet, in the back of my mind, I could hear these words, "Don't go there. Don't go there." Well, you know, you don't pay no attention to that. So the next morning I got up and used my dad's car to drive there, and I found him eventually after I got lost. And I found it. It was about 10:30, and he comes outside, and I said, "Johnny, what in the hell is this smell?" "Oh," he said, "I should have told you. My sewage broke." Yeah, well, what do I know? I believed it, like everybody else. So we went in the house, and I said, "The smell in here." Yeah, because down below the living room is Johnny Gacy's cemetery, which no one knew about, not even me. So I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to talk, and I'm gagging. And we must have talked for about an hour or reminisced. I'm sure we did about the Christmas show that's in my book, the restaurant we did together, the Christmas caroling. And then at one point, I said, "Well, you know, I got to go soon because I got to get back home. My dad was going to fix spaghetti for me. I love spaghetti meatballs. I'll never get it the way he did it, but at least that was then." So anyways, we're getting ready to leave. He said, "Oh, wait a minute. I got something I want to do." And I said, and he goes in the bedroom. He comes out with some handcuffs. And he says to me, "Would you try these handcuffs on?" And right at that moment, sir, I tell you, no, anybody can contradict me all they want, but the good Lord was looking out for me. He said, "Tell him to get you a glass of water." So when he went to get the glass of water, I grabbed my dad's keys. I'm trembling, but I can't put a connection on it yet. I'm scared to death. No connection yet. So I run, and I try to get out, and I run up against a wall, and I fall on the floor. And it's all there documented in my book. And then I get up, and I run outside. He comes after me. He says, "Don't leave my side." Now, that would have been the old Johnny, because that's how he talked to me, you know. I got to the car. I couldn't get the keys in. My water's running off me like a fountain. I'm hysterical. Whatever. Anyways, I get in the car, and as I gun it to pull away, I look back, and he's got his hands up in there. He says, "I'm going to murder you." Now, that you would have thought that would have clicked me right then. No. What happened was I thought I had offended him by not doing the handcuffs, because he said he had the keys, see? No. He was mad because he hadn't finished the job that he had thought he was going to do, and that is kill Barry, his friend that he grew up with. Because in my back of my book, I write, "Running from the Devil, 360. So I go to my brother who lived in McHenry, Illinois, and I told him the whole story, and I'm hysterical, of course. And he's trying to make sense and tails out of it. I said, "I think he's going to kill me." And he said, "Oh." He said, "Try to make sense." And he says, "Calm down." And I tried. I'm saying these words to him, but I really have not grasped the whole thing yet. I moved to Florida to be with my brother, because my mom was gone, everything. And while I'm working for a landscaper, in 1980, the call comes to my my boss hears over the radio that Johnny's arrested, blah, blah. Right after he did this to me, there was about a week or 2 weeks, detectives come back to his house, and you know the rest of the story. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting there, and he says, "You know what? I got bad news for you, but I don't know how you're going to cope with this." And I says, "Oh, my father died?" I said, it's okay. I prepare myself. "No," he said, "it's about John Gacy." I said, "What did he do?" He said, "Turn on the radio." And that's when it all came back to me. That's. And I did not work for about a week. And then I was able to do a little bit as I could. I couldn't get it out of my mind. He really was going to kill me. He really was going to kill me. And then we went into counseling, which I wrote in my book, and hid it, told the American people what it was like living with nightmares one after another. and I left with it. And then when I started the book in 1994, May 10th, when they executed him, that's when my heart really poured it out, because I knew him when he was a little boy like myself. And I tell everybody, whoever wants to hear it, try to understand. I didn't know him as a serial killer. I knew him as my friend, who him and I had done some crazy things together and drove the neighborhood nuts. But when I learned what he had done, then I realized he had so much evil. But when you see his life he lived, he had a wonderful mother. She was very close to me, and I miss her. And as the others, they're all gone now. Just Karen and I are alive. That's Johnny's sister. They're all passed on. And she was unbelievable. But anyways, I used to go over there for dinner. Sometimes I was lucky to grab Johnny away from the kitchen table, my friend. Other times, Mr. Gacy and his rages and his abuse and drinking, he'd come up those stairs for no reason, run over to the table and hit Johnny in the face with his fist. For no reason. Just because he couldn't stand him.
So I'm curious of that, you know, having all this information and you having this insight into that, that when you, on a day-to-day basis, when you see movies or TV shows or even news, even, you know, regular broadcast news, when another type of crime or criminal comes out, and the fact that, you know, they sensationalize the bad stuff.
Yes,
and I'm wondering if you kind of think, well, yes, they've done bad things, but they didn't just start doing bad things.
That's exactly what I've tried to portray since my book came out, since I had my signings, since I did 45 radio shows in 2009. This is what I tried to say. You're asking me, and I'm trying to tell you, how I know the Johnny that you all know as a serial killer. I know him in another time. I have a hard time separating when people say things to me and I see someone on the screen. They don't know the whole story. Did the reporter go back? Did they talk to the grandmother, the great-grandmother? Did they talk to the father, the mother? Did they talk to the neighbors? Did they all get their stories straight? Do they all know what made it? What I'm trying to say to you is, people say things, but they don't have the whole story. This is why I wrote the book, Johnny and Me, so that you, as a journalist, as a newscaster, or what your job entails, you would now be able to read my book and realize the Johnny, the real Johnny, before he became the loose cannon.
And I'll end with this question, try to end on such a despairing note, and that what is there a good memory of you and Johnny that you try to remember more than anything? More than all the bad stuff.
What I remember, you know, I'm trying to hold my emotions back. It is very hard. Sir, when I wrote the book, I cried more tears than anybody will ever know. Only God will know. When I put those words down and knew I was actually reliving the nightmare all over again to my family and our connections and Johnny and his family. What I remember of Johnny was, he tried to reach out, and he tried to do what he thought was decent and good, but his father would not give him the time of day. Mine, I gave up a long time ago. Johnny and I were two kids, as I put it in my book, if you get the book, Johnny and Me, a steam locomotive going down the track 60 miles an hour, trying to reach out for the biggest star that we can grab, to make something of our lives. We knew that we were the footballs. We knew that we were going to get the blame right and left, and we did. I'm not saying that the other members of my family didn't suffer, or Joan and Karen got it, but Johnny got it the most, and so did I. We got the revenge and the hate for their lives. I put in my book, neither father, mine or Johnny's, loved themselves, so how could they love anybody else? And my memory is of Johnny singing, "O Holy Night," as we went Christmas caroling 50 years ago in the cold snow on the northwest side of Chicago. And having people cry when they heard his voice will always be in the back of my memory. Yeah, he had a gorgeous voice. And it's I have three regrets. One, that because of my father's attitude toward me and all the things that he could have done with his dad was very politician. He knew Mayor Daley. He knew all the FBI. He knew everybody in show business and football, baseball stars, because he was in the cocktail lunch business. I could not go to him and say, "Dad, will you do me a favor? With your connections in show business, could you try to get Johnny maybe into there and we get his voice a little bit better?" And who knows? I couldn't do that because my dad would say, "Who are you?" You know? But for anybody outside the family, oh, he'd give you his shirt off his back because that's the way he was. So that's one regret. Another regret that I didn't go to visit him at Menard Prison like I had planned, but my family stepped in and said, "Don't go there. Leave our name fade out." And my brother threatened me with it. And because of that, I could have gone there. I could have laid out the whole scenario. I could have told him why he did it, what was behind it, and the whole nine yards. I know. And I know he would have said, "You're right on there." But it never happened. So those are the two regrets that I'll take to my grave. And as I said, I'm going to be 70 very soon. And this is Christmas and everything. I think of my mom. I do. She was wonderful. I think of my sister who's gone. And I think of Marion. I think of Joanne, who passed away 2 years ago. That's Karen's older sister, from cancer. And now Karen and I are the only two left that can tell the any truth of anything about the whole story. She went on my website, sir. If you go up there, you'll see. She said my book is awesome. Mr. William Forsythe, God bless him, went and put a letter up telling everybody, go, if you want to know about a serial killer, read Barry's book before he was one. He gave me he took me home last year, flew me home, him and Clark Peterson, so I could see my house for the last time after 40 years. Yeah, I'm very sentimental in many ways, and this whole thing is very sentimental to me because I talk of a different time period. I talk 50 years ago when ice cream was 10 cents a dip, which I put in my book, and talk about the moths being 27. So you see, you've asked the thing that I wish others would have said to me. What is the most important, what is the thing that really brings you or bothers you or remember? Johnny singing "O Holy Night."
Okay. That was fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, that was crazy.
All right, Aaron, you're back.
Yep.
Okay. And Dean, you're back.
Yes, of course.
There has to be like a balance between, I guess you have to accept it all, that behavior stems from somewhere and yet can't excuse it.
Yeah. Yeah. I genuinely was moved by my discussion with him. I thought it was really good. So I haven't seen the film. I have the DVD. I have not watched the film, but
William Forsythe, of course, plays Gacy in the film.
You know, some people were born to play certain roles. I think William Forsythe was born to play John Wayne Gacy.
Wow.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of the more fascinating conversations we've had on the show. Outside the box. So
it was definitely outside the box. It was a good, really good interview, Aaron. Very good
Merry
way to
Christmas.
End. Good
Merry
night.
Christmas.
No, really good way to end the live broadcast. I really think that's what people are tuning in for.
Well,
on that note, should we go ahead and just wish everyone a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year?
Yes. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Bless you all.
Yeah.
Dean, Aaron, Jerry, have a great holiday.
All right, thank you. Same to all of you.
Here's a little Christmas cheer to end off the show, guys. Good night.
Happy holidays.
See you next time.
while the merry bells keep ringing. May your every wish come true. Happy holiday, happy holiday. May the calendar keep ringing. Happy holiday to listen, and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.